Hi, good evening, and welcome to New Orleans Radio. Greg Barth here, and thank you for joining tonight. Before I bring our guest on, I just want to prepare you for one thing we could encounter, probably won't, but could. Earlier today, you might have heard my interview with author Roy Harper, and he described the the hellish and chaotic conditions he experienced when he was incarcerated in Parchman Maximum Security Prison in Mississippi. Well, tonight I'm interviewing a crime fiction author from that very facility. So neither of us have any control over the background noise, the chaos or the things that that you might hear. But I guarantee you this is one interview that you're going to want to hear. Joining me tonight for this episode is crime author Chris Roy. And if you have a question for Chris during the show tonight, you can call us at 347-633-9609. That number again is 347-633-9609. So, Chris, good evening. Thanks for coming on the show.
Hi, Greg. How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing well, man. It's good to get to talk to you. Good to have you on. First I want to say congratulations on the release of Shocking Circumstances.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it was a lot of work getting to where I'm at now. I appreciate that.
Yeah, we'll talk a lot about the book tonight. It's pretty impressive, but I want to find out more about you first. Usually when I'm introducing a guest, I'll read a short bio about them. But, in your case, I think your story is so unique. It's best that everybody hears it from you. So if you could take a minute, a few minutes, and tell us about you, Chris.
All right. I'm always uncomfortable, awkward talking about myself. I could start where I grew up at. Ocean Springs, Mississippi Gulf Coast. I had a really good childhood. I wasn't a well-off childhood. I grew up in a trailer with rats and roaches and in a trailer hood, I guess you could say. A lot of crime and burglaries and kids getting in trouble. And I was involved in all that. I had a good time in school. I made it through up to 12th grade before I actually had to repeat a grade. I got in trouble and got expelled, so I lost my opportunity to get a diploma. I got into parties and drugs and stuff like that, unfortunately. My wife since then has been in prison. And I've been here for 17 years now. It's changed significantly. Actually, I've gotten away from involvement in drugs and crime and violence. And I've done some good things in here. I got my GED. I do a lot of exercising. I've trained a lot of guys in here in boxing. Other than that, I got into writing, and I enjoy that very much. There's not a lot to do in here. So writing, exercising, reading. That's about it. I don't have a lot of my life is sitting in a tiny cell all day thinking up stuff to do, and the books are my greatest achievement.
Yeah, well, the upbringing that you describe, I can relate to a lot of that. A lot of people go through, not starting out on the best conditions, poverty, trailerhood, like you talked about, experiences with drugs. I mean, what was different, for you? What brought you to be spending the last 17 years in prison, if you don't mind me asking?
All right, that's no problem. There's a lot of things that brought me to where I'm at now. The incident that I was arrested for and convicted for was murder of a guy I was involved with doing drugs. He was a Vietnamese leader of a drug gang, and we went to school together. We were friends for a time, and then We did. We had a series of deals that went really well, and then one went really bad. I had a run-in with some police who they actually took some money from me, and it was money that I had owed the guy. And well, he had no understanding of the situation, and he ended up threatening me, threatening my family. And so the next time that we had met, I was at a friend's house working on a car, and he and I got into a fight. He came at me very aggressive, and I know this guy was known for carrying weapons. He was known for violence, like drive-by shootings, and yeah, he was very serious. So I took him very serious. So yeah, I was protecting myself, and it was just a fist fight. There wasn't nothing planned, or it wasn't a planned murder. And anyway, that my public defender could not convince the trial, the court otherwise. And so it doesn't matter where you are in Mississippi or any other state. If you go to trial with a public defender, you're not going to get the outcome that you're hoping for. And so it turned into a circus at the trial. It was a rout. The prosecution kicked my side to sleep and convinced the jury that I had actually intentionally murdered the guy in a fist fight. And you know, despite all this other evidence, and it was evidence that my public defender could not present or stress well in court. It was, that's the incident in general, what led me here.
Wow, man. I mean, you know, I'm missing something here, but, you know, usually when you hear about somebody in a fist fight, you know, kind of the heat of the moment, that ends in a fatality. It's, I don't know what they call it, you know, manslaughter conviction, I think, which doesn't carry a real stiff sentence. I mean, that's, do you feel like this was injustice in your case?
Absolutely. When I was in a county jail, I witnessed many, many guys in there that had similar charges. They had murder charges, capital murder charges. And, you know, they would take a huge group of us to court, and I would witness these guys get up in front of the judge with their lawyers and get their charges dropped to lesser sentences from capital murder down to manslaughter. Many, many times I've seen these guys doing that. And their crimes were more heinous than mine. With the media, you know, they covered their stories. And like, man, these are some terrible guys. They went up and robbed this guy, shot this guy, stabbed that guy. There was weapons involved. And it was obvious murder. And they kind of dropped down to manslaughter. And I was thinking, man, so I got into a fist fight with a guy. I might go home behind this is nuts. And so that wasn't the case. What I learned when I got to trial was the difference between me and those other guys, they had paid private attorneys, and they were far more better than the public defender I had. And so, yeah, you know, I have my wife is building a website called Unjust Element. And along with her and along with the support group, they are building a site to bring attention to my case. And we are going to invite people there, well, they will, on social media. They will invite people there to get to know me and get to know my case. And hopefully we can attract legal representation for another appeal. And ultimately, we'd like to get back in court and fight this case again.
Well, that's great to hear, Chris. I know the more people I talk to, and, you know, even earlier today, I mean, you get a feel for how things work, and that I'm learning about Mississippi and the, you know, the penal system and conditions. And I hear in just the contacts I have through being a crime writer, this concept of making donations to charities that don't give receipts. You know, money goes a long way. And you know, when you talk about the people who are able to afford the better attorneys, you know, what kinds of deals they're able to get. It just, your story just strikes me as something that definitely bears a second, third, fourth look in the legal system. So thank you for sharing that. Now, you know, as I understand it, your situation is, you know, maybe complicated a bit because you've managed to escape from prison on a couple of occasions. What made you want to try that? So where was your head in that moment? How did you do it, and how did that work out for you ultimately?
Well, I had, after trial, I had a family member, my aunt, she could afford an appeal attorney for me. She kicks herself in the butt for not getting an attorney for me at trial, but she did get two appeal attorneys for me who filed a total of four appeals, all of them denied. And so, you know, after that last appeal was done and over with, I lost all hope in getting out. Four appeals, each one of them, I got my hope up, and it got dashed when the court turned it down. So that process happened over several years, and it was the same thing over and over through two attorneys, four appeals. And at the end of that, I was like, okay, I was in my early 20s. I'm not going to stay here until I'm 65 years old, until I'm eligible for parole. There's no way. And so I started considering escape. I didn't really take it seriously until Hurricane Katrina, and that was in 2005. Katrina hit the coast, wiped out four homes of my family. And my mom was in a garage. She was living in a garage. My aunt's house was wiped off its slab. She was living in her yard with a tent covering her family. It was ridiculous. And so that really escalated my idea into a plan, a real plan. I had dreams of actually, you know, escaping, getting away, finding work, and then helping my family. And so I was able to get away. I had some friends there who helped me, and I had a friend of mine named Hippie, and I helped him get out. He needed an address to ERS to his early release, and so I helped him get out on early release I had a cell phone at the time, and I called, and I actually impersonated his uncle, and I told the parole officer, you know, hey, this guy, why isn't he out? I got to work, wait for him, et cetera, et cetera. And he was like, oh, well, we're great. That's great. He has family who cares about him, who has work waiting for him. So let's get him an address. Well, they got him an address and approved it. He got out, and he came back and got me. You know, we planned. We kept in touch through cell phone. We coordinating an escape. And the cell I went out of had a solid steel bar, and it took me 6 hours to cut through it with a sawzall blade. And the safety glass, I had it taped up so it wouldn't shatter and cause a lot of noise and distract or attract attention to what we're doing. So I taped it up, and I busted it with a lock. And a friend and I went out the window. It was on the second story, so it was a nice little drop to the ground. I used my jump rope tied to the bed. We went out the window. And I went down first. I dropped down. My friend came out next, and his leg got caught on a shard of glass. And so he was hanging upside down by his leg, and another friend was shoving him out. So he finally gets out. His leg, his Achilles has got a big cut on it. We climbed a fence by a nurse's station, a nurse's rest area. It's behind a clinic. Climbed the fence, got on the roof. We dropped down in front of administration, and when we went through the fences, we went through two gates, and my friend Hippie, he had installed the locks on these gates. He was on the maintenance, and he left a little gap in the conduit for the electric lock. And so I had some pliers, some lineman pliers I bought from an officer for $50. I cut this wire, and when the power was cut, the lock opened. So I went through both gates in just a matter of seconds. And we ran across the parking lot, went to a ditch, went to the highway. My buddy was waiting for us, and we jumped in the truck and left. Well, we got to a rest area, and I had a friend of mine in prison call me while we were going, and he said code red and hung up. That meant that they knew we were gone. We were gone maybe an hour away, and they knew they were gone. So, well, Hippie, he had to get back to his alibi. So he dropped us in the woods by a rest area. Well, the next morning, my friend and I was figuring out, okay, we're not going to steal a car. That's going to leave a trail, and that's not a good idea. We don't want the U.S. Marshals having anything, any way to track us. So we was figuring out who can we call to give us a ride, and we had to wait on Hippie. Well, Hippie, he was driving around like he was going to work. He put some wood and tools in the back of his truck, and the Marshals, the U.S. Marshals, were following him around trying to figure out. They knew he had just got out. They knew we were friends. They had went to the prison and talked to people, and they investigated, and they knew he was the number one suspect that was helping us. So they were following him around, so we couldn't do with him anymore. Well, my buddy, he knew an officer he was very friendly with. They did business and whatever. He called her, and she actually was off that day. She came and picked us up and drove us to Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Now, they wanted to get a hotel room and have some private time. So I said, okay, that'll work. Now, we cannot use your real name. We cannot use a credit card. You got to pay in cash. Use a different name. And I explained why. She said she understood. So we found a hotel. We get there. She goes in and pays, comes out. She's like, okay, we're good for 2 days. Now, I take her car and go shopping. I drove around to a grocery store. I went to a thrift store, bought a bunch of clothes, and I'm just super excited. At that time, I had been locked up for 6 years. And here I'm driving around and talking to people and just waving. I was just Mr. Friendly to everybody. I was just so happy to be out and going around and checking out all the stuff. So I went to a dollar store, bought some stuff, went to the thrift store, like I said. Anyway, so I went back to the hotel, and her and my friend, they went out and got some food and brought it back. Well, she left, and later at night, I was sleeping. My friend, he stayed up. He was watching some documentaries of Timothy McVeigh robbing banks, and I was sleeping. And then we got a phone call about 2 o'clock in the morning. And was a sheriff, and he told my friend, I was looking for Gregory Malone and Christopher Roy. This is Sheriff so-and-so. I'm down here with a couple of U.S. Marshals. And my friend, he put the phone down. He woke me up and said, it's over with. And so I jumped up, and I grabbed my phone, started deleting everything, and we got dressed. And I ran into the bathroom. I looked in the vent. I looked at another vent. I was trying to find some kind of way out of the room. We were on a second story. There was no way out. And we're like, how the heck did they figure out we were here? So I figured that she had told some people, and they told her. They told on us, but that wasn't the case. Anyway, I told my friend, look, I'm not going to do anything stupid. I'm going out there. So we stood there by this little mini fridge. We had some Hawaiian punch and some other drinks, and it was the craziest moment. We're sitting there guzzling Hawaiian punches, just staring, just shocked. We drank like two or three of them back to back, and I was like, man, I didn't even get to eat my chicken. We had some Popeye's fried chicken. And so I was like, well, that was ridiculous. So it was the funniest thing. We sit there, we guzzled these Hawaiian punches, and I'm like, okay, I'm going out. So they started to beat on the door. It was about to kick it in. And I went, I opened the door, and they're all, show me your hands, screaming, all that stuff. I go out there, and it's just guys everywhere in SWAT gear. They got submachine guns, the whole deal. And I'm thinking about, okay, I can jump over the rail. I look over the rail, and there's a guy down there in the parking lot kneeling down. He's looking up at me with a shotgun pointed. I'm like, okay, now it's a bad idea. All right, here's my hands, So they cuffed me. They got my buddy. And the U.S. Marshals came and, they got in front of the SWAT team, they took over, whatever, and they're looking at me, and they're looking at a piece of paper that has my ID on it. Well, I had grew my hair out, and I shaved, and I looked completely different from the picture they had. It was a picture of me when I was 20. I think I was 24 when I was on a skate. So it was a four-year-old picture, and I looked completely different. And they asked me my name, and I told them a name that I had memorized. I knew the name, social security number, birthday of a guy from my legal work I'd memorized, and they were like, okay. And they asked my buddy, like, who is that guy? And my buddy said, I don't know that guy. I don't know who that guy is. So They took us to the Tuscaloosa police station and fingerprinted me on this NCIC computer. And my image popped right up. And I was like, okay, that's him. So that was over with. And we didn't know how we got caught until months later. We got some legal work. And we seen that my buddy's friend, the officer, she used her credit card to get the hotel. She used a different name, but she used a credit card. And so we was like, we told her not to. We had, and she had money. We had money, and you know, we didn't understand why she used her credit card. But that's how they found us. They went to the prison. They questioned, you know, who do these guys hang out with? They knew my buddy was doing business with this officer, and they're like, okay, well, she's off today. And the U.S. Marshals checked their computer system. They said, well, she used her credit card right here. Look at this, a hotel room in Tuscaloosa. It was that easy, they caught us. So, well, they
wow.
took us to, yeah, yeah, they, well, they took us to, back to Parchman, and they handled us pretty rough on that deal there. They took us back to Parchman, and we were locked down high risk, and, wow, what a time that was. We were put in a different cell every week. We were shut down multiple times a week. We didn't have anything. We weren't allowed to have shoes or fans or anything. No radios, no TVs. It was just a screaming madhouse all day. And to come out of the cell, you want to go to shower, to yard, you have to strip naked. You got to strip completely down every day to go to the shower, to go to the yard. And you're putting shackles and handcuffs to come out of yourself for any reason. It was very, very difficult living conditions. And so about 3 months after the first escape, they took us back to court in Meridian to have a hearing to decide what we're going to do. We're going to go to trial or what? Well, I've seen how they escorted us there and into the courtroom or whatever. Well, they set a hearing, and I was like, okay, so when we come back for this hearing, I'm going to try to escape again. I'm going to run off. And my buddy and I, I made a handcuff key, and he made one. And I made one out of a Bic lighter, out of the plastic head where the flint spring goes in. And, yeah, I shaved it down to a little handcuff key and kept my mouth. And when I went to the yard one day, I tested it to make sure it would work, and it worked. And so we made some clothes. They give us these jackets, these navy blue jackets. And I got one that was like four sizes too big, and I made some running shorts out of the sleeves. And I made a pair of pants for my buddy out of a sheet. And we got some money in through legal mail. And so when they brought us back for the hearing, we took our handcuffs off, took our shackles off, and the coats, when you got your jacket on, you can't see, and your hands in your pocket, you can't see the waist chain or the handcuffs on. So we took them completely off, and we just zipped the jacket up, put our hands in our pocket. And I had some tape. I taped the shackles to my ankles so they can see the chain between my legs. So when I got up and walked the door, when they opened it up for us to get out, I jumped down and I walked out a little bit, and my buddy got out. One of my shackles popped loose, and the canine guy yelled at me, "Hey, how'd that get like that?" So I reached down, I snatched the chain off, and took off running. And all four officers, there was two officers driving our van, and then two canine officers in another van that were escorting us. All four of them took off running after me and left my buddy there. When he darted off in the other direction. And we couldn't. He didn't get a chance to actually get away because have a good chance. One of his shackles would not come off. It got stuck. We broke both our keys on it, so he didn't get. Yeah, he didn't get another chance. That was a hell of a deal. We was going through in the van. Trying to get his shackle off. We realized that he's not going to get to go. But when they ran after us, he tried it anyway. He went off in the other direction, limping away. Oh man, I ran about three blocks. I went around two of them twice. One of the canine officers shot at me, and the bullet, it hit a row of cars I was running next to, scared the crap out of me. And so I kept running, and he ended up colliding with the car. And I'm talking about, he hit it hard. He hit that car so hard, it caved in the hood, busted the windshield, flipped over it. And he got up with his gun still in his hand and kept on running after me. The car took off. Police chased the car thinking that they were there to pick me up. And the car got away. They never even got on the car. So I don't know who that was, but apparently they saw a 6'5" canine guy in camouflage with a gun and freaked out and hit the gas, you know. They didn't know who that is. So, yeah, they took off. And the poor canine guy, he gets hit by a car. He keeps chasing me. I ran off this building foundation. It had like a 4-foot drop off this concrete foundation. And I was running full speed, and I don't know how I landed and kept going. It was tough. So later on, the canine guy, he asked me about that. He's like, "Did you see that building foundation, the drop off?" I was like, "Yeah." He's like, "I didn't see it." So he busted his butt on that too. And he had a really bad day. I ran, and I had those shorts on that I made. They were under my stripe. I had some red and white stripes on. I jumped in the back of this truck. I snatched the pants off, and I had these shorts on under them. So I had a bandana I had made out of a square sheet that I put on my head. So I jumped out. I'm walking down the street. Now I got shorts on, bandana, and I'm walking down the street. Downtown Meridian, there's people everywhere. And by that time, police started, you know, swarming the area. They were blocking off the area, looking all up and down sidewalks. They looked right at me. Several of them did. I walked right past them. And there was this lady came out of this business way down. She started screaming, "Hey, there he is right there. He was in the back of that green truck." And I had got away. This lady pointed me out. And they were like, "Oh, man, he changed clothes already. There he is. Get him." And so this officer jumped on my back. And I'm trying to sling him off of me. He bit me. He sunk his teeth in my back. And he had like this death grip on me. I couldn't get him off. And by that time, I had ran for so long, I was out of gas anyway. But they got me. And it was another strange, wild thing. They slammed me down on the concrete, put a knee on my head, and I'm on the pavement. And not 10 seconds later, there was a camera. I looked up, and there's a camera in my face. And it's a news reporter standing in front of it. It's this nice-looking black lady in a pantsuit with a microphone. She's like, "We're live on channel 7, blah, blah, blah." I'm like, "What is going on here?"
Oh,
so the officers, it was like she had to have a scanner or something going around tracking what was going on, right? She was on the scene. And I'm like, "Man, okay, this lady just saved my butt from getting beat," right? The officers, I seen one of them, he looked into a side mirror on a cop car, and he started like, you know, fixing his hair, make sure he looked okay. And they put me in, the car, and they rolled down the window in the back so the camera could still see me. And it was just ridiculous. So I didn't even, my head was swimming. I was like, I felt like I was set up or something, you know? And that was wild. And the officer, the canine guy that got hit by the car and fell off the foundation, when he was chasing me, the canine people, their radio frequencies they're not picked up by the Meridian police. So when I ran, they had the police department had no idea until the canine guy shot at me. The police were looking for somebody with a gun. So they found him. They drew down him, made him get down and give up his gun. And he had to show his ID and everything. And yeah, it was bad. So, I mean, they made this guy get down and give up his gun. They almost shot him. And he gave his ID, and they gave him his gun back. He started chasing me. That's when he fell off the foundation. And then when they had me, when they were about to put me in the car after they had cuffed me and they were in front of the media and whatever, I seen an ambulance, and I asked one of the officers, I said, man, nobody got hurt, did they? And he said, yeah, canine guy got hit by a car. I said, man, he's okay. He's like, well, I don't know. And by that time, the canine guy walked from the ambulance toward us. His face was so red. He had his gun in his hand, and he said, it's a long ride back to Parchman, boy. And like four officers grabbed him and took his gun from him again. He was really upset. Later that evening, I was in the hospital at Unit 42 here in Parchman. And anybody that escapes, they bring you to the hospital, whatever, for a checkup. And the canine guy came and sat down next to me. And we had a conversation. He's like, man, look, I understand what you did. I'm glad that you didn't hurt anybody. A lot of people run off and they intentionally hurt people. I was like, man, that's not me. I would rather sneak away and do it like that. I'm glad you are okay. And he said, yeah, I'll be good. So they got me twice, man. And now I look at it like this. You know, the idea of me escaping and getting away and starting a life somewhere, it's a delusion. It really is. Most people in here, they talk about, helicopters coming to pick you up, and we got a team of people kicking in the door with guns and coming to you. It's a delusion. So I don't take that serious anymore. I did in my books, though. People will see that. I did that in my books. There's an escape scene in Shocking Circumstances, Book 3. The opening chapter is an escape scene that is based on what happened on my second escape. And it went different, though, in Shocker's situation.
Wow. Well, Chris, I mean, that's exactly why I wanted you to tell your story. I mean, this for the listeners, we haven't even gotten to the fiction yet. This is an amazing story. I really think you need to write an autobiography at some point. I mean, it's a compelling story. Chris, this morning I had an opportunity to talk to author Roy Harper, who spent a lot of time in Parchman himself, and he describes some pretty hellish conditions. You know, decades of segregation, chaos, sheer insanity. How long have you been in Parchman, and how are the conditions for you there, Chris?
Well, I came to Parchman the first time in 2001, right after my conviction. And I was in Unit 32, it was a supermax. I was there for about 2 years, and the conditions, wow, we didn't have anything. They wouldn't allow us to have radios, TVs, shoes, anything. We didn't have a fan. The summertime there was incredible, man. There were guys dying from heat stroke and falling out nearly every day. I mean, it was just, there was no reason to even go to the shower because the showers were scalding hot. There were steam, there were saunas, and you couldn't breathe. And so you go to shower, and as soon as you get out, you're sweating again. And there was guys that would just lay on the floor in a puddle of water. And if you got up too fast, you would sweat for an hour. And there was no way, there was no way to stay cool. Things changed the second time I was in Parchman. I left in 2003, went to population, and I was there for, I was in Meridian for a while. 2.5 years. I did a lot of things there. I got into working for the education department. I got a GED. I was a valedictorian of the GED class, and I ended up being a tutor teaching math. And I did a lot of other things do paintings for classrooms, and I built props for plays that the education department put on. I did a lot of stuff in the library. It was not bad. I had in population where in Meridian it was about as good as prison can get for Mississippi. I did a lot of tattoos. Actually my cell was set up like a tattoo studio, and I've done hundreds and hundreds of tattoos there, and even on a couple of officers, a couple of nurses. I could get anything I wanted from the clinics, latex gloves, ointment, alcohol pads, iodine, opticide, whatever I needed, and I had the free world inks. I did a lot of tattoos, but even with all that going on, I had a cell phone, tattoos going on. I was still in prison, so that's when I escaped. You know, it was still prison. And I escaped, and I told you the escape story. So when I got caught, I went back to Parchman. This is in October 2005, and I've been here since. Unit 32, it got better for a while. We had a big lawsuit that Roy Harper spoke of. He and Margaret Winter spoke of in their interview in the last show. They, together with a class action of prisoners and the ACLU lawyers, they shut down Unit 32. They made conditions better there for a while with incentive programs for segregation inmates like myself and Roy. And so they developed this high-risk program where we could work our way to more freedoms through good behavior. And that's still going on today to a certain extent over here in 29. 32 closed from the lawsuit in 2010, and I've been in Unit 29 since. Actually, the conditions have worsened here. You know, they were okay when we first came here as far as the high-risk guys and death row. I've been housed with death row since 2005. And well, the conditions were better for a while, and administration changes, and then the administrators, they want to administrate. So they got to change rules, and even when there's nothing wrong with what's going on, they still have to change something because they want to do some kind of paperwork to put their footprint down on what's going on, some kind of security thing. And they make things worse. They never make things better. And, well, that's the situation here in Unit 29. It's progressively getting worse.
Yeah, it sounds not good. Chris, we've got about 18 minutes left, so I definitely want to get into shocking circumstances in the novel and you as a writer, but your story is so compelling. Can you tell us, you know, quickly how you became a published author in prison, especially under the conditions that you've described? I mean, I know writers who, you know, can't write on a great day. How do you do this from a prison cell in the conditions you've described?
All right. So I started out writing short stories. And this was in 2007. I was in 32. And I was around some really good guys on high risk. Roy Harper was one of them. And he had written his books, Shank and Heist. And I read them, and they were really good. I read the handwritten versions. And he actually inspired me to want to write a novel, want to get published. And so him and a couple other guys, we all talked about what we could do if we got published. You know, we have all this time, we got talent, we have enough ability, we can put together a book and get it published. And then we can use the money, save up, and get a lawyer and get out. That was the ultimate goal. And so that was really, yeah, we knew we're not going to escape again and get away. That's not going to happen. So let's do this. And we can actually get something going here and use our stories to, get out to the people, make a little money, and save it up. We might actually get out. Well, that's how it began. And we started, I started reading a lot of books on writing. And I read a few really good books on writing. How to Write a Breakout Novel was one of them. And after that, I started putting together shocking circumstances. I would read these books, and each section would give me some kind of idea, and I would jot it down. And I only have a limited amount of knowledge, skills that I can put into a character, mechanic, some engineering knowledge, boxing, tattooing, that kind of stuff. And so I wanted to create this really, really interesting character, unique character that hasn't been done before. And I've read hundreds of novels in lockdown. It's nothing to do but read. So I've read all these novels, and I know a good character. And so I I said to myself, what is better than, what's more impressive than a guy that has all these skills, that can box, that can tattoo, that can do work on cars? How about a female that can do it?
So
a strong female protagonist. And I read this book by T. Jefferson Parker called Ellie Outlaws, who had a strong female protagonist. And I was like, yes, that is the kind of kick-ass, that's the kind of kick-ass female that I want. Something like that, something that makes you sit up and really focus on reading and get that thrill and start actually cheering the character. Even if they're doing a crime, you're like, yeah, do it. Shocker had developed from many, many things, actually. The book, the storyline, I don't know where to begin, how that story progressed. My writing process is really weird. Sometimes, actually most of the time, I'll sit down and start writing. I have no clue what I'm going to write, no clue at all what I'm going to write until I sit down and start writing, and then the ideas start flowing out. I will get, usually I have a rough outline that I jot down, and I'll have a few things, few ideas I want to write about, and I'll just sit down and start writing, and it'll start coming out. So I get ideas from a magazine or a song on the radio or something. Well, when we got to, we don't have TVs right now, but we've had them in the past, something I see on TV. And I'll just be sitting down reading a novel and something will pop in my head that has nothing to do whatsoever with what I'm reading. And I'll just jump up and I'll start writing it down. And then I'll write about it the next day. There are a couple of things in the book and shocking circumstances that are based on real life stories. And one of them is the escape story. I'll tell later on. I got another trilogy called Sharp as a Razor, and it has a fight scene in it that's based on a real life story with my coach. And yeah, my coach, he had a hell of a life, and he used to tell me all these old stories. And one of them, he had a fight. This was back in the 60s. Him and his friend got into a fight with a bunch of football players at a beach. It was called, and the local paper covered it. And the title of the headline of the paper was Battle at the Front Beach. Anyway, I'll leave that for readers to get into later, but they'll see that and they'll know now that it is a real story.
Wow. Yeah, Chris, you're touching on so much from the novel that I wanted to talk about, but you're covering it. But Clarice, you know, she's a fighter, she's a professional boxer. The way you write those fight scenes, you know, you put the reader there in her head, in the ring, with the sounds, the lights, the adrenaline, the satisfaction of landing a punch. A good solid punch. And I read those scenes and, you know, first it's clear, you know, the sport. I also get the feeling that boxing is a serious study of yours. And if circumstances had been different, you'd be there in the ring. Is that very far off the mark?
Oh, absolutely. I've always had that dream, especially since meeting my trainer. And wow, we've been through so much. I'm still in touch with him, by the way. As far as my dream of becoming a professional boxer, that window is closing. I'm getting older, and my chances of getting out of prison are super slim. And unless this thing happens with Unjust Element, as far as wanting to be a part of professional boxing. I still have hope of getting out. I believe I will get out one day, and I will become a part of it in some way, probably in the role of it as a trainer. And I've trained numerous guys in prison, and even in lockdown sections, there's been I've trained guys because of the way that these cells are set up. We can see each other, even from our cell to cell. We can see each other. We'll make punching bags and hang them on the bars and do some training or. In this high-risk incentive program I mentioned, whenever I was whenever I was able to go out, there were several years that I had on high risk. I was able to come out and go around and talk to guys cell to cell. We did all kind of training then. There's a lot of guys that I have inspired that they want to get out and become professional boxers as well. And yeah, that's been a big, huge part of my life.
Yeah, it definitely shows. I want to make sure that we save enough time at the end to talk about Unjust Element. So maybe one more question about writing. Shocking Circumstances isn't your first novel. What have you learned as a writer that maybe you did differently with this one than some of your previous work?
Well, it's definitely more polished. There's a lot more to it. My first book was self-published. It was a collection of short stories. It introduced these characters, Razor and Blondie, and the title was By Hook or Crook. Well, I had no experience whatsoever with fiction writing. I had never studied the art of it. So I had basically just sat down and started writing. And these stories, I had some friends on death row and high risk who read them, and they were like, man, these are pretty good. And they explained to people, it was basically like a how-to book on how to commit crimes and get away with them. That's basically what it was. Mostly things that I had learned from criminals in prison. You know, guys in here, criminals, they talk about the crimes stories. A lot of them talk about, hey, this is how I'm going to do it when I get out again. You know, space is basically a finishing school. This is not a rehabilitation. There's nothing correctional about this Department of Corrections. And so I hear all these stories and I'm like, wow, this is some good stuff. I've internalized them. I've thought about them. I've researched them. And I put them in my stories. And, yeah, so that was my first book. And I look at it now, I'm like, man, it's crap. So I don't want people reading it because I want to redo it. It was good back then. It's still, people read, there's copies floating around prison now. People read it and they're like, man, they're blown away by it. It's more of a street fiction style.
Yeah.
And I don't want to do street fiction. I want to do crime fiction, hardboiled noir. And yeah, so Shocking Circumstances is a lot different. I studied several books and I upped my game on that one.
Yeah, I mean, I got to say, it's you have such a strong voice in Shocking Circumstances. You know, as a writer, it's something that we all try to do, and we kind of get a sense of your setting. We hear things in the background, the conditions you're in. I'm just in awe of what you've been able to accomplish in that book. Really hope that everybody checks that out. Who would you say are your favorite writers? Which of them inspired you the most, Chris?
Favorite writers? Actually, I like fantasy guys as far as first person and emotional description. The best guy I've read is Jim Butcher and his Dresden Files series, his Codex Alera series. Incredible, incredible. Let's see. I like Robert Jordan, Wheel of Time. As far as crime books, I like Lee Child. T. Justin Parker, I mentioned him.
Yeah.
I'm a big Stephen King fan. I love Stephen King. I've read probably 25 of his books. Those are some of my favorites.
Great writer. What advice would you give to somebody out there who is neck deep in trying to write their first novel and can't quite see their way out of it?
Well, people get overwhelmed thinking about the enormity of the book. They'll try to encompass the whole story instead of breaking it down in parts. And if you don't have the natural ability to just sit down and start writing and you get overwhelmed with, wow, I got this to write, that to write, oh man, it's too much. You need to have a detailed outline. You need to have a very, very detailed outline. A three-part act, beginning, middle, end, and break down those three parts. Okay, in the beginning, this is the first part. Well, what happens there? Break that down in as many sections as you can. very super detailed outline helps people to get overwhelmed. And you got to remember that nobody's going to see your first draft. It doesn't matter how crap it is. It doesn't matter how bad it is. Nobody's going to see it. So just sit down and write it. And don't worry about editing. Don't get stuck in editing mode. Stay in creative mode. Don't write a paragraph and then rewrite it, rewrite it, rewrite it, and get stuck in editing mode. You have to be mindful of that.
Yeah, I like that. I think that you have to get it out of your head and make it into a real thing that you can then go back and polish and shape and do something with. It's the act of getting it out of your head is kind of the awkward part for most first time writers. But if you
yes.
enjoy, I think, every aspect of writing, you know, the shaping of the story, the building of the story with you know, the three act outline, as you say, the detailed outline, then know that the writing of it is just, you know, turning it into a tangible thing, and then taking that and making something of it. It's a matter of
yes.
knowing that it's going to take time, right? I think that's very
yes,
wise.
And people get stuck with, they don't know what to write. They get stuck with the creative part. Well, to spark creativity, it doesn't have to be in writing. To get that part of your mind active, the creative part of your mind active, do something else. It could be photography or artwork, anything that's creative, crafts, some kind of arts or craft, it doesn't matter what it is, something that's going to get that creative part of your mind active, and then go back to try your writing again.
Yeah, I think that's key. There's this pressure out there to write every day, and I think that writing every day doesn't mean typing away on a keyboard. It means, you know, every aspect of this. It's the thinking, it's the brainstorming, it's doing something else and allowing your subconscious to shape the story.
Absolutely.
Chris, I want to make sure we have, you know, enough time. I don't think I reserved enough studio time actually for our chat tonight. But you've got a website out. It's still under construction, but man, it looks great and it has a lot of excellent content. And really, it's one of the best sites I've seen, and it's called unjustelement.com. I'd like for you to talk to our listeners about the site. I'll link it to Noir on the Radio on Facebook after the show, but I want to make sure we have a chance to talk about that real quick before we lose time.
Okay, the Unjust Element is run by Volunteer Support Group, and I couldn't have what I got going now without them. They've helped me a lot in getting published, getting my content out there on social media. They run the Facebook, Twitter accounts and all that stuff for me, you know, for the author Chris Roy accounts. They have the Unjust Element accounts as well on Facebook and Twitter. So please check them out there. The purpose of the site is to show people that, you know, who I am as a person. And it has a lot of things on there about my novels. There's some blog posts on there about my writing process, creativity, and stuff like that. There's a 60 questions Q&A that people can go check out. There is a section on my artwork. It has a big gallery, a lot of drawings I've done in prison since I was in a county jail back in 2000, all the way up until now. Things I've done for my family, for my coach, for my wife. And there's a lot of things. A lot of pages are not finished yet. It's still being built. The things about the court, the appeals, you know, the legal stuff on there is not finished. It's still being built. A lot of good stuff on there. I hope people go check out and share with their friends.
Well, Chris, I definitely feel like we're just getting started, and it's already time to wrap up. But thank you so much for coming on the show, talking to us about your work. I know we'll stay in touch, and I'd like to get you back on when the next book comes out, you know, just to catch up with you and how things are going. I'll put a link out for Unjust Element. So, folks, I encourage you to check out Shocking Circumstances, just released from New Pulp Press. You can get it on Amazon, and I highly recommend it. Noir on the Radio will be back for a special edition tomorrow night at 9 p.m. Eastern. I'll be hosting a panel discussion on the Parker novels by Richard Stark and their influence on crime fiction today. The panelists include Eric Pruitt, Tony Knighton, Rob Pierce, and Sean Cosby. You won't want to miss that. Until next time, this is Greg Barth with Noir on the Radio. And Noir on the Radio is a copyrighted podcast solely owned by Authors on the Air, Global Radio Network, LLC.